Hi, is this good? My name's Cindy Masters. I'm an alcoholic. I don't really need a microphone. Never have. never been a demure kind of gal, but that's all right. As I said, my name's Cindy Masters. I'm an alcoholic, and because of the grace of God, some simple actions in this program and both sides of sponsorship, I've been sober every day in a row since December the 17th, 1985, and for that I'm very grateful. And it's really the biggest deal in my life. It continues to be, and I have a pretty big deal life today, but that's the biggest. And I love your theme, see and share love. Almost every talk I give, I talk about that love's the answer no matter what the question is. And that's really been what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've learned it through working the steps and navigating through the traditions and you all loving me when I was very unlovable. And when I got here, love was not even, I couldn't feel love and I couldn't give love. I was incapable of it. And I didn't really even believe in love. I think maybe I believed in lust, but I did not believe in anything that I know today as love at all. And from in any kind, familial or any kind of love, it just wasn't real for me. And it's funny, I live in Louisville, Kentucky, and the Dalai Lama named us the Compassionate City. And and our mayor's taken it and run with it. And I own a business today, and I'm a part of a compassionate organization. And almost all compassion comes from love. And I didn't have any compassion either. You know, and that's another thing that I've gotten in Alcoholics Anonymous, compassion. You know, even, because the first thing I got in AA was, and I have no idea where I'm going with this, I've never said any of this stuff from the podium in my life. Like when I got here, the closest I got to compassion in my first, say, 5 years of sobriety was that if you had done something like I had done, I didn't judge you because I had done it too. And that's the beginning, little tiny kindergarten compassion. And then today, I can have compassion for you when I don't have a similar experience. I didn't have to judge you at all, even if I've never done anything similar. And I can love you and care about how much pain that maybe you've been in that caused you to behave that way or good or bad. And that is a miracle. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about what it was like, and you'll understand why that's such a big miracle, and we'll circle back to it. Because I come from a background that's crazy, and I'm a person that shouldn't be here. And I'm a person that just shouldn't be here. I just shouldn't be here. I shouldn't be a productive citizen. I shouldn't even be allowed to vote, let alone actually vote. I shouldn't be somebody that spends my life that people would trust me to help them. I spend my life trying to help people, but the honor of that is that people allow me to, that I'm a trustworthy person for somebody to get emotional and intimate with. And so where I come from is that, I've been drinking my whole life. I drank since I was about this big. I drank for exactly what it talks about in the textbook of Alcoholics Anonymous. I drank for the effect produced by alcohol. I hear people, speakers, they say, well, it made me taller, it made me prettier, handsomer, or whatever. It didn't do any of that for me. See, I felt like I was bleeding from the inside out. My life, I felt like I was more unfair than anybody I had ever met. My world was small. And what alcohol did for me is it let me not hurt as much. It felt like there was a tourniquet on the bleeding. And that's why I drank. I drank to not hurt. I drank because I thought it hurt less. And in the long run, what happened is that thing that helped me hurt less ended up causing me all this pain. And I couldn't see it because I still associated it with the thing that made me feel better. But yet it was the thing that was making my life explode and cause me all these problems. I was going to go fast through this. You know, I'm a hard-drinking woman. You know, I had no reason not to. I had no reason not to. I had no reason to try to be productive. I grew up and I was adopted to start with. I wound up back in the system. I wound up in lots of foster homes and institutions. And I was really angry. I was really angry, angry, angry. And drinking at it, you know, that was the best thing about my life, when I could get in a place that I could do that. By the time I was 17 years old, I've been in 25 institutions, state mental hospitals. hospitals, foster homes, that type of thing. I did not go to high school. I went to a bunch of high schools. Like when you live in a state mental hospital, you're in a special ed high school. And when you go to a juvenile jail, you're in a juvenile jail high school. And when you go to here, you're in this high school. And so I did all that for part of a freshman year. And by the time I was 17, I'd hitchhiked from one end of this country to the other. I lived in Washington, D.C. three different times on my own. And I did what you do in order to survive. And you can use your imagination as much as you want, and it's probably true. You know, but I don't need to go into the details up here. I just don't. You know, that's my past. It's not who I am, but it's what I had to do. It's all I knew, you know. And I wanted to, you know, there's a line in our book, and it says, you know, that we stand in this place, and we have to pick, you know, we're going to pick up this spiritual toolkit, or we're going to blot out our existence to the bitter end. Well, I was already blotting my existence to the bitter end. There was nothing to look forward. I didn't have a dream. I didn't have a hope. I didn't have nothing I was going to grow up and be. There wasn't nothing to look forward to. I didn't care. I wanted to die. I tried to kill myself. I wound up in ICUs with things in my nose and, you know, people not knowing if I was going to make it and blah, 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 blah. I didn't die. Apparently, God didn't want me to die. And so I drink, and I wound up in hospitals with alcoholic poisoning. It just went in a circle. I'm like a cockroach. You just can't kill me. And you'll see that that's even been true sober. I didn't care about nothing. I was barely 17 years old. I'm living in D.C. Cincinnati was my home base. My foster home, which was the best thing that ever happened to me, my foster brother and sister had muscular dystrophy. And they were the only people I could care about. And the only reason I cared about them is that life had been less fair to them than me. See, they couldn't walk and they couldn't feed themselves. And so there was only people that I ever saw that I had compassion for, that I was like, you know, and we would all feel sorry for ourselves a lot, you know, but I got to also help them. I was useful in that foster home, a thing that I wouldn't know again until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I got to help put them to bed and help them cut up their dinner and even feed them. And what that did was that was probably the one little tiny thing in my life that gave me self-esteem, that made me like I had some value because I could make some difference to somebody. But it wasn't enough. I got thrown out of that foster home because I couldn't not drink. I got thrown out of that foster home at 14 years old, and she wanted me there and they wanted me there because I was helpful, but I couldn't not drink. I just couldn't. And so the next 3 years, I'm back and forth all over the country doing what young girls that are living on the streets do. But my foster brother was having a terrible back surgery in Cincinnati, and I used the only mode of transportation that I really knew, and that was my thumb, and I hitchhiked back from Washington, D.C. to Cincinnati to be there for that surgery. And what happened was that he survived it. Nobody expected him to. And what I did was the same thing I would have done whether he died or whether he survived. If he died, I would have called it grieving. Because he survived, I call it celebrating. And what I did was I got loaded, because that's what I do. And I'm a blackout drinker. I'm a blackout drinker. I drink, and I can't tell you what happened. I can't. I can wake up in the middle of a conversation and try to figure out where I was. You know, like, well, what was I saying? You know, or where am I? And I'll tell you what, as a woman, that's really scary, because you can wake up in some very compromised positions and not know if you volunteered or not. And it's terrifying, right? Seriously. What I woke up to, and what I'm going to tell you is, because I don't remember, this was what was shared with me. I woke up hanging in University Hospital in Cincinnati on a wall. I was strapped down from my chest all the way to my knees with straps on a stretcher, which happens because you flip the stretcher on your face because you're so mad. So they hang you on a wall to save you from yourself. It's black and blue from my chin to my knees, and I woke up saying the same thing I always said when I woke up in jail or anybody else. Who did this to me? Because I was such a victim. See, people were always doing bad things to me. You know, and it was always their fault. And it was always, look what's happened to me, poor little Cindy. She's been in all these institutions and all these foster homes, and life's been so terrible, and wah, wah. And now somebody has beat her half to death. In reality, what happened was the nurse said, you did. And the nurse said, by the way, the county sheriff's on his way. You're not going to juvenile. You're going to county. See, I'd burnt the system out. I've been in so many places. People try to help me. I was so angry. You weren't allowed to help me. The minute I got a chance to go get loaded, I went and got loaded. And then I blamed you. I blamed you for why I never had any chances. I couldn't see my part in it. That's a beautiful thing that happened when I did my first four step. It's like I was so scared. I didn't want to see my part in it because then it let everybody off the hook. And then when I got to see my part in it, it empowered me because it meant I didn't have to live like that. It meant it never had to happen again. I didn't have to put that ball in motion again. And what a beautiful thing was that. So anyway, I had seven felonies. And when I was drinking, I was scared like a lot of us, so I carried a gun. And what I found was that, like back then, I didn't really talk that much. And nobody that knows me now would really believe that. But but what I found was that if you weren't paying good attention to what I had to say, if I brought this gun out, you listened real well. Now, I didn't really want to shoot anybody. I just wanted you to do what I wanted you to do. You know, like that's how I did, you know. And so my friend was trying to run away from me. I don't think you can imagine why. But so she ran into a retail store because what crazy person is going to run after them with a gun into a retail store? Well, this crazy drunk in a blackout runs into this retail store waving the gun. Now, this is told to me, and I'm waving a gun. Now, you know that's against the law. In Ohio, you know, they're not big gun people. You know, they're not that far south. So, you know, it's like, it's like here I am waving his gun. And then, you know, you try to explain, like, when the police come, why you need to keep your gun. That's a bad idea, too. And each one of these little things I'm saying, they're called felonies. And you get the idea. And that, you know, I think that might be what they mean in the big book by, like, well, we judge ourselves by our intentions. The rest of the world judges by our actions. I wasn't trying to commit armed robbery. But when you go into a store with a gun, guess what that's called? Whether you take anything or not, that's called armed robbery. And there's a whole long thing. You know, when you kick a police officer, that's a bad thing, too. When a whole bunch of them got to fight you, that's a bad thing. And when you do these bad things over and over and over as a juvenile, they're sick of you. There's nothing left to try with you, so they take you to adult jail, and you don't get to go to baby jail anymore. And honestly, both are bad. Adult jails, for me, was not that much. It was actually, juvenile jail was a little bit worse for me than adult jail. But so I went to adult, but I was more scared of it. Because it was the thing that you're threatened with, you know, when you go to prison, when these things happen. So I was scared of it. And I wasn't scared of much anymore because all the bad things had mostly happened. So what was there to be scared of? I got really lucky, and I was malnourished, which is another thing people have struggled to see today. But it was true. And I was beat up by the streets and the cops, and I ended up going into serious withdrawal in jail, and that was the good news, because then they took me back to the hospital, and that's how I found out how you got hung on the wall, because they tied me down, and I flipped a stretcher on my face, and then they hung me on a wall to protect me from myself, and long story short is somehow I got to go to treatment. It was 1980, so this was 5 years before I would end up getting sober, and I went through treatment in a podunk place with a bunch of cornfields and a bunch of old men. I don't think you could have put together a set of teeth from all of them, all right? And I wasn't relating a lot, you know? DUIs and stuff, and back then people could get 8 and 10 DUIs. It was before MAD, and so it was different, you know? And I'm there. I never got any DUIs because I was always in trouble for stealing the car. And that was a bigger deal back then. But I'm there with a guy, and I love to tell this story because he got a DUI on a tractor. And I didn't think I could relate to him, right? So here's a toothless farmer with the drunken tractor driving charge. But after I finished the treatment, I could relate to him. And what I could relate to him about was that the reason he got the DUI is he did me. See, I drink, and I get so stupid. You know, I just get dumb. I think I'm above everything. Nothing applies to me. Nobody can see me. It's like I'm Wonder Woman with an invisible lasso. You know, and I really like, I'm just like that. You know, like that whole like crazy alcoholic ego. And apparently him too, because he forgot where he was in the middle of the highway and put the plow down. And and that's why he got caught. And see, that's what I do. You know, like I drink and I just get so stupid and I do such stupid things. You know, it's not like I do. I'd love to, like, I like to be, because I like to be cool. Like, I, especially back then, like, I'm from the streets and I'm kind of tough. And, you know, really, there's nothing very cool about my drinking. I throw up on myself. I urinate on myself. I'll pee on you. You know what I mean? It's like, because I don't know where I am or what I'm doing. So there's nothing very fun about it. That's the truth. You know, and it's important that I remember that, you know. It's like, I mean, I'm not a fun date to take home because I'm just not, you know, because I'll pass out and then puke on you and, you know, nothing fun ever happens. And that's the truth of my alcoholism. So anyway, in this treatment center, I had about a 5-word vocabulary, and you can imagine what it was when I got here. And I used it like a weapon. See, I wanted you to love me, but I wanted to prove to you why you couldn't. And so every time you get near and you try to hug me, I'd be like, don't mess with this. And those old farmers, they hadn't heard some of the words I used. And but something happened that had not been my history. No matter what words I used or how much I threatened them for touching me or, you know, those kind of things, they just kept loving me. Because that's what we do here. See, we love. That's your theme. That's what we do. They didn't say, Cindy, when you can talk right and dress right, be here. They said, come back. We love you and we'll love you till you can love yourself. Sometimes I think we lose that today. Sometimes I think we think people should come here well-behaved and well-dressed. I would not have been allowed in Alcoholics Anonymous for at least 5 years. You know, I never would have made it. See, I couldn't do it. I didn't have it to do it. I was too scared. And so nobody made me do that. And they said, Cindy, because I said, you know, I didn't have no life. I didn't go to high school. What was I going to do? What was my life going to be? You know, I'm not a kid still, but I've been living this crazy adult life for a long time. And they're like, Cindy, work these steps. They were on the wall like they are everywhere. And your whole life can be different. And I said to them, I wish that was true. I said, I wish I had your little alcoholism. I said, I wish I had that. And I wish I could work your little steps and my life would just be like everybody else's. But you don't understand. See, I'm broken. And I believed it with everything I had. See, every time I was in a state mental hospital, they gave me a new title. You know, I had them all. I was somebody that could not ever be functional. It was in paper. It was in writing by doctors and judges and on and on. And I really believed I was too broken for Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought I was faking it to be an alcoholic to explain my crazy so that I would have a place to go. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous when I got out of that treatment center because it was the nicest place anybody had ever been to me. And I came and you guys let me sleep on your couches. And you bought me coffee and you gave me pies and I manipulated and I conned. And all I got to do was love Alcoholics Anonymous because of it. I couldn't stay sober because I wouldn't work those steps. Because if I worked those steps and it didn't work, it proved everything they ever said was right. It proved I was too broken for anything. It proved that it was done. And I was so scared to try it. I was just too scared to try. So I found a couple fellas in AA and took them drinking. You can find anything you want in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm telling you, fellas, and I say this all the time, the reason they say to stay away from new girls is to protect yourself. Because new girls know just what to do. And I that's what I did. I manipulated and I got a couple guys. But see, I always break out in felonies. And so, because when I drink, I get a sense of entitlement. and I think I deserve things. After all, look at the way I grew up, and why do I have hardwood floors and those people have carpeting? Now remember, this was the 80s, okay? Why do I have to have the horrible hardwood floors and they got carpeting? So I got drunk and got these guys to go help me borrow some from a model home. How dumb is that? How dumb is that? See, that's what I'm, you know, but here's the good news. I'm so dumb when I drink that I always get caught. Now, I'm going to tell you about my brothers later, and I got two brothers, and we, you know, ducks don't come from chickens, chickens don't come from ducks, and their outcome has been really different from mine, and I mean, I'm in my 30th year of continuous sobriety, and a lot of it has to do with that I got caught enough, I got enough chances. See, every time you get caught, you get an opportunity. Every time you get locked up, I don't care if it's in prison, jail, mental hospital, whatever, you get some kind of a chance, and once in a while, one of us grabs that chance. And that was my good news. I got caught enough till I finally took a chance, and that was in Alcoholics Anonymous. But it wasn't this time. I went and borrowed some carpet. And I'd been around AA for about 6 months, and it was a county I'd not been arrested in before. And anyway, the little probation officer lady, she knew that I loved Alcoholics Anonymous. I did. I never felt like, oh, I can't believe I have to go to AA. I can't believe that you guys let me come be with you. You know, some people come here, they feel like they're too good for AA. I came here and didn't feel good enough for AA. You guys had cars, places to live. You were clean, you know, and for the most part, you treated me pretty nice. And I loved AA. And I didn't feel like I deserved it, and she knew that. And she gave me a shot. She made me be an emancipated adult. She said, "You've been living like an adult a long time. You gotta be grown up." And she sent me to a halfway house in Lexington, Kentucky, called Chrysalis House, that had just began. There were no halfway houses for women in Ohio or Indiana at the time. The closest halfway house was in Lexington. It housed a total of 8 women. That's all there was for women in a 3-state area in 1980. This was 81, right after January. And I went there and some things changed for me. I learned some things that I still use today. And some of the things that I learned was that the way I began to feel like I belonged in AA is that they made me show up at a meeting early and help. And they made me stay late and help. So I wouldn't start being a coffee girl. You know what happens when you're the coffee girl? Everybody knows you. That feels like popularity to somebody with as low self-esteem as I got. It's like, they know my name. I'm coming back, you know? And you start to feel like you belong somewhere. And then you know, I learned that I can't, I wanted to get the right shrink. I wanted to get the right probation officer. I wanted to get the right program. And then I was going to feel better. And then I was going to like myself. And then I was going to have a life like other people have. I had it so wrong. You see, what happened was I started to act like other people act. And I started to like myself. And I started to feel better. And because I acted better, my feelings changed, not the other way around. That was really hard for me to get my head around. That's what I learned there. They made me go get a job, a J-O-B. Well, when you're 17, you're an adult, but you have not even a high school education. What kind of J-O-B you think you can get? I got one setting tobacco in the field, and that's hard work. And it was really hard work, and I didn't want to do it, and I was mad that I had to do it. But you know what happened when I went ahead and set that tobacco, and I had a little bit of money in my pocket, and instead of manipulating some man to buy my coffee and cake after the meeting, I paid for my own. No, thank you. I'll buy my own. You know what happened? My shoulders went back. My chin went up. And I began to like myself. I began to feel worthy. You stopped being those people and started being us people. Because I was behaving like you. It changed. Then they said, "Cindy, we want you to go take classes and get your GED. GED. Well, here's my response to that GED. I said, "That's for losers. That's for people that didn't go to high school." Who wants one of those? So can you hear the fear? See, that's what I do when I'm afraid. When I'm afraid, I don't want it, I don't like it, it's no good, it sucks, because I can't do it. See, I knew I was street smart, but I thought I was dumb. So they said, "Go take this test to see where you should be in the classes." I took that test, guess what? I didn't have to take any classes. They said, you take this test. I'm a good tester. I scored in top 2 percentile of anybody that's ever taken that GED. That I can't take credit for. That's God. See, I was so mad at God. What God take from me? What God didn't give me? Well, what God gave me was some raw intelligence that I don't get to take credit for any more than somebody can take credit for what they look like. Those two things, I can't take credit for. How I live my life, what I do, my behavior, that I have a part in. And so, but what happened was, that thing that I hated, that GED, who wants one of that? I don't want to be a loser. I don't want people to know I didn't go to high school, because that's the only people who get a GED. All of a sudden, it's like, look at me. I'm Cindy. I got a GED. And see, that's what I do. That's how I do. I got out of there. I went back to Ohio. And I was an AA Wonder Girl. And you've seen us, you know. When you come from a very low bottom, everything looks great, you know. Like, because if you go from a 5-word vocabulary to 20, it just really is impressive, you know. And so I actually went to college. And I worked. And I went to AA, and I did the deal, and I hated college. I had a 3.8 GPA, which is really good. It's almost straight A's, and it was in a difficult study, but I hated it. I'm not that kind of person, and there's nothing wrong with that. And the reason I share this with you is that I hear a lot of people from the podium, and when I was young, I thought that if you were a successful AA member, it meant that you went to college, you got your family back, and you bought a house. That's what I heard people say. And I'm telling you that it has nothing to do with being a successful AA member. I didn't finish college. I left college because I hate college. I don't plan on going back. It is not my cup of tea. I'm an entrepreneur, and I'm really good at it. And I do have a house. That's a miracle. There was no family to get back. So, but what makes a good AA member for me is somebody who really, really, really gets still and says, what's God's will for me today, and who can I help? And some of the best AA members live in the projects. Money does not make us a good AA member. Financial success does not make us a good AA member. How we look and how we dress does not make us a good AA member. For me, being a good AA member, and what it says in the textbook of Alcoholics Anonymous, what it says is that I put my life on a service plane. That means that you are more important than what I want. Because trust me, there are a lot of things I wanted to do this weekend. A lot. And I do this a lot of weekends. A lot. And I have a really busy life. And if you do this kind of thing out there in the world, they give you trophies. They give you awards. Volunteer of the Year, blah, blah, blah. And my ego loves that. My ego loves that. Cindy Masters, Volunteer of the Year. Cindy Masters donated this. Cindy Masters did this. I love that. I don't get any trophies here. I don't get any awards. It's not a recognition. This is a heart. And this is where it matters. This is service. You know, and that is what, for me, makes my life worthwhile. It's the juice. It's what makes everything good. It's the thing I respect the most in other people. Not to do service for ego. I've done that too. I've done service for ego. How can I give enough that you all in AA think I'm great? But service for service, because I want to give, because I want to touch you. Because I want you to touch me, because you saved my life and I can't ever pay it back. Because every time I try to pay it back, I get so much that I try to give that back and I get more, and there's just no way. There's no end to this cycle. You know, it's like there's no way to give enough. I am nowhere like on my story, so who knows what's going to happen tonight. But we'll have fun. I'll tell you, I stayed sober almost 3 years. At 2 years sober, at 20 years old, I went to make amends because the committee went going. What a piece of junk I am. If people really knew what I was and who I was, they wouldn't like me. This popularity in AA is a lie. They didn't really like me. They just think they like me. If they knew the truth, they'd hate me. You know, that blah, 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 you know, that great little, I don't just have a committee, I got a firing squad, you know. And And so, you know, I used to drink at that. And at the end of my drinking, that'd still go on. I'd be stone drunk. What a piece of junk you are. And so if drinking don't work for it, then maybe you can put a bullet in your brain and maybe that'll work. That is always something I thought about. Always, always, always. And always for my first 10 years sober. Always for my first 10, 11 years sober, when everything went crazy, I thought about killing myself. I'm not proud of that, but that's the truth. But I will tell you that I haven't really thought much about that for about 19 years. So things get better, and some of us come in different places than others. But the good news is I never did it. And it wasn't like I sat around thinking about it all the time. It just came up. And I am way, like, who knows where I'm going? Sorry, you guys. But I went to make amends to the Muscular Dystrophy Association because I had essentially robbed them. Even though I loved them, I did a fundraiser for them because I wanted to help. See, my heart has always been good. People say we're liars, cheats, and thieves. I do not believe that. I do not believe that that is my core. I do not believe that that is how I was born. I do not believe. I see, because I am a child of God. You see, my God is so big and so great that my God wouldn't make a liar, cheat, and thief. I became a liar, cheat, and thief. I reacted to life as a liar, cheat, and thief. There's no doubt that I was a liar, but it's not who I am at my core. It's never been who I want it to be. I've always loved. I've always loved. And I've always wanted to do something good. I just got in my own way. And my alcoholism got my own way. So I did this fundraiser, and I wanted to invest the money in the only kind of business I knew about. And you can imagine what happened to the money. And so really that's also stealing, even though I try to do something good. So it's like I hated myself. See, we're not insensitive people. We're extremely hypersensitive people. When I do something wrong, it bothers me forever. I have to drink. It kills me. My conscience, if I go and do something wrong, if I steal and lie today, I will have to drink. Maybe not today, but I'll be drinking in the next year or two. Because I don't live well with doing the wrong thing. And I drink at it when I do. Or I make amends. That's all I can do. So I went and made amends to the Muscular Dystrophy Association. And it was very brave. Because I thought they might put me in jail. Now they wouldn't have. But you know how fear is. Fear's not real. Fear's not based on real. Fear's just fear, and it just traps me, and it just, like, owns me. And my life becomes a reaction to all these things I'm afraid might happen or could happen or would happen. And what a horrible way to live. So I went, and I made amends to the Muscular Dystrophy Association. You know what they did? They asked me to volunteer. That was my amends. I said, what can I? I said, I was wrong. This is what I did. I'm writing you a check because, see, writing a check's important. What else can I do to make this right? And they said, how about you volunteer for us? Well, I did. And I am somebody who can, I don't know, man. I got 1,000 angels. And it's like, I did this fundraiser and a weird thing happened. Anyway, long story short, they asked me to be, they lost their executive director for the outlying counties in the greater Cincinnati area. There's Hamilton County, that's the main Cincinnati, and then 8 counties that include Northern Kentucky. And at 20 years old and 2 years sober, they offered me that position. And my ego said, I'm recognized. I knew if I just had a chance, if people could just see me, I would rise to greatness. And my ego took that job, and they gave me business cards, Cynthia R. Masters, Executive Director, Muscular Dystrophy Association. Woo boy, I went to Clubhouse and passed those out. I said, you two work the steps, and you can get a business card. They gave me a secretary. What do you do with a secretary? I hid. I bought a new car. I got a house. See, this is where, like, you know, this did not, I thought that's what I had to be good. I thought that's what I had to be successful in AA. So my ego took it. But, you know, that egomania with the inferiority. See, for me, I've always got to be more to be enough. I don't ever think I'm better than you. But I think I need a little better car to be good enough for you to ride in it. I think I need a little better house so it's good enough to invite you in. Now, to you, it may look like I'm trying to be better than you, but I'm not. I'm just trying to be as good as you because I have such a fragile ego and such little self-esteem. And so I took that job, and I was scared to death because I knew I had just been on the streets 2 years before. I lied, and I was so overwhelmed because I told them I was a high school graduate instead of GED. And you should have heard me on New York telling them I lied. So a year, I'm at this job, and I've got to do things that somebody like me can't do. I had to put on the local Jerry Lewis telephone segment, if you remember that, back when you'd have your own little local one. I had to go to Las Vegas on a plane. I'd only hitchhiked. You know, it's like, I thought I knew how to dress, buddy, because I'd watch magazine. I bought a fuchsia skirt suit with a purse and shoes that matched. I looked like a neon sign coming down the road. It was embarrassing. They had to talk to me about dressing appropriately for the job, the regional director. You know, I mean, it's like I really had no business in this job. But what I did was I didn't come to AA. See, in AA, there's two things that we have to do pretty much really well if we want to stay sober. We have to absolutely completely admit defeat. If we don't recognize the problem and completely define it, we don't stand a chance. And then we must have the capacity to be honest. Well, I didn't understand what honest meant. Today, what honest means is that I will be transparent and I will be authentic. You see, I can't be an AA self, a work self, and a person self over here, and a self over there, a biker self, and a this self, and a that self. I have to be one self. And I have to be honest. Honest means I am myself for me. That's what it means. It means that I am transparent, and it means I don't pretend, and it means that I don't lie. But I went to AA, and instead of telling you I'm scared, I don't know what to do with the secretary, I don't know how to do this job, I don't belong in this job, I came to AA and told you how great I was, and you two worked the steps, and you can have a new car, you can have a person choose that match, you can have these things. And I passed the disease instead of the message. And I'm living a lie. I'm doing what it talked about in the fifth step. In the fifth step, it talks about that we live two lives, and I'm doing it sober. And I can't stay sober and be this person and this person. It won't work for me. And I wound up drunk at 3 years sober, and I don't remember drinking. And I woke up, and I was so relieved. And the reason I was relieved is I didn't have to go back to that job. See, I didn't want that job. I knew I couldn't be in that job. But I thought to be good enough, I had to have that job. And that job almost killed me because I needed to be good enough. I needed enough stuff. I needed the right things. And that's not what I need. It's not what I need to be happy. It's not what I need to stay sober. You know, I need to be authentic. I need to be transparent. I need to be of service. And I came running back to AA the next day because I'd watched so many people come in and out, and I thought, I drank. You know how they ask if anybody, you know, I just drank, and I want to be sober, and I thought it'd be that easy. And I left, and guess what I did? I drank. Because, see, that thing that talks about in the doctor's opinion had happened. The phenomenon of craving that I didn't plan on had kicked in. See, once I put some in me, I don't wake up and get to make any choices about drinking. The drink makes the choice for me. That's the advantage of being sober. Today I can ask God to help me to not drink, and I get to not drink. But then, not so much. This went on for almost a year. By the end of the year, the only really terrible thing happened. My car got repossessed. I got evicted from my place that I lived. All the people I hung out with were like me. We lived with whoever had a place, whoever had a job we drank on. We moved around with whoever could get a new place, and that's the way my life looked. Not that bad. My last drunk was December 16, 1985, and what happened was I sat in front of my apartment and I cried. And I cried and I cried because I was waking up out of a blackout, and it's very scary waking up out of a blackout as a female, and I didn't know where I was. Now I'm right in front of my house, but I don't know where I am. And this hard, tough street bride was sitting there crying because I couldn't find my home. Where's my home? And I'm drunk, and I've urinated on myself, and I've puked on myself because that's the kind of sexy alcoholic I am, mind you. And I need to remember that. I don't say that to be gross or graphic. I say that because that's alcoholism. Alcoholism is not pretty. It's not. My obituary would probably say, Cindy Masters, drowned in the toilet because I would puke and pass out while I'm in the middle of puking. That's what my alcoholism looks like. The next morning, something shifted. I woke up and I said, God, help me. And I hadn't said those words. I didn't know what God was. I had a higher power that I didn't know what it was. And I had a really hard time believing that any God could have possibly loved me, you know, with the life that I've had and with the way that my life had gone. And something just let me, I didn't care anymore. It was just, help me. If you're out there, help me. And I came back to AA different. I came back to AA with some humility. And what I mean by humility, the first time I was in AA, I was very smart. I had almost a photographic memory. I memorized the big book. And I would go to meetings and I would use it like a... And I would use it like a weapon. And I old-timer would misquote the big book. I'd go, bum, 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 Mr. Old-timer, you're wrong. Paragraph 4 does not say that. And so I was very popular. And the first thing that my sponsor said, first of all, I was willing to have a sponsor that did not understand the Oxford Group, nor the Washingtonians, nor the entire history of Alcoholics Anonymous. See, I knew it all, but I couldn't see the forest for the trees. You know, I didn't know how to put it on my life. And the first thing that she said is, you're not allowed to quote the big book anymore. Now imagine that. She says, you may only talk about it as it applies in your life. So I didn't have nothing to say for a while because I didn't know how to apply it in my life. I didn't know how to put it in my life. She made me look at the first step, and I looked at it differently than I'd ever looked at. Powerlessness and unmanageability, look at my life. Not hard to see, not hard to admit, not hard to own. She had me look at what were the probable consequences if I drank again. This is my experience. It's not in the book. And I said, well, the probable consequences, we always talk about it, right? Die, go to jail, go to a mental hospital, right? She laughed at me. She said, you're not afraid of any of that. And I'm not. See, in jail, I live so good. I'm like the vice president, you know? Like, I get how jail works. I grew up there. I'm good there. In the mental hospital, shoot. The bar is so low. All you got to do is get more pudding than somebody else, and you're like the queen, you know? I mean, it's just not hard to be a success in jail or a mental hospital. It's just not. It's out here that the problem is, you know? And death, that's like the next adventure. I've ridden a Harley almost my entire recovery. You know, that's not somebody that's really afraid to die. It's just not. There are cell phones out there, you know? So she made me dig deep, and I'm really grateful that she did. Because here's what I came up with. Here's what I'm really afraid of will happen if I drink again. See, when I drink, I don't like this, but this is my truth. When I drink, I'm a black hole. And I suck the life out of anybody that gets near me. I lose my capacity to love. I lose my capacity to feel love. I don't want to use you. I want to love you, and I believe I love you, but I'm going to use you. I'm going to get what I need, and you're not going to get between me and a drink. And that is who I will be. I will hurt everybody. I will tell you I will be at that baseball game, but as soon as I start drinking, I won't show up. That is who I am. I don't want to be that. It's not who I think of myself. See, I think I'm generous because I'll give you the shirt off my back. And then I'll borrow your wallet because, after all, I gave you the shirt off my back. That is why that I still stay so centered in Alcoholics Anonymous and work so hard in this program. I don't want to be that. That's the worst thing I can be. That's the worst thing. It's not in jail. It's not in the mental hospital. See, I could go to jail sober and I could be useful. I could be useful. I could go to a mental hospital sober and I could still be useful. But in that state of mind, I am no use to anybody, myself or anyone else, or my God. No use at all. So that was my first step. And I'm a step person. I'm a big book person. I'm in the middle of this deal. I had to reconcile this thing with this thing, God. God scared me, and I still can't describe God to you for me. What it says in the big book is that God is infinite and I am finite. And for me, I cannot box God in, because God is bigger than my brain, and my brain can only absorb boxes. And so for me, I just trust that God is so big and so loving and so kind, and that God loves me. And that God gives me the ability to love you. And that whatever that being is, I've called God Christ, I've called God Buddha. I've been through it. I've been a breatharian, I've been a vegetarian, I've been a seeker, and I continue to seek. But for me, the only time I have peace, and the only time I have happiness, and the only time I have fulfillment is when I am trying to serve that greater good. when I am trying to be helpful and be in the presence of that spirit, my life has value. Now I want to share with you, because the rubber meets the road with how we do this sober. Like, you know, drinking, we all know how to drink unsuccessfully, otherwise we wouldn't be here, right? But how do we live sober? When the rubber hits the road and things happen, how do we get through that? How do we navigate? You know, because life is life. Life's difficult. It just is. That's the truth. So how do I be happy, and how do I enjoy it, and how to be present no matter how difficult it is? You know, how do I do that? Now I'm going to share some stories. You know, when I moved to Louisville from Cincinnati, that was a challenge because they did AA differently. And my big lesson in doing that was that what I had to learn was that, because I went and I wanted people to recognize me. I was 9 years sober. And I wanted people to know me the way they knew me in Cincinnati. And I want to know why you weren't recognizing me and why you weren't reaching out to me. And what I was reminded of, and what I stay reminded of, is that it isn't about you reaching out to me. It's about me reaching out to you. And once I started looking for the new girl, and once I started looking for who I could help instead of how I was going to feel, and who was I going to help feel better, all of a sudden, my life got better and a fellowship grew up around me. And today I love Louisville AA. Back then I used to tell them about Ohio AA, where AA was founded, and couldn't figure out why I wasn't making friends. The next sort of like kind of monumental thing was my grandmother died. And in my life, there weren't a lot of kind people in my life. And there were people that were kind, but there were no people that were kind consistently. You never knew what to expect. You know, like they might be kind and then they might kick you through a door. And my grandmother was the kindest, most loving human being that I ever knew. She's who taught me love's the answer no matter what the question. She's the only person I ever saw. She goes to church on Wednesday, goes to church on Sunday, and she never threatened me. See, everybody else that went to church all the time would threaten me. They'd say, God's mad at you. You're going to hell. And I'd be like, oh, I want to go to church. No, I didn't. My grandmother said, God loves you, period. And she said that to everybody. My grandmother grew up in an era where it was popular to be prejudiced towards certain groups of people just because of the color they were born or whatever. My grandmother never uttered a negative word about a single person or group of people. My grandmother didn't just say love was the answer, she exampled it. She loved. Love was the answer no matter what the question. She taught me, see, with AA, sometimes we say, fear and faith can't live in the same house, and I completely disagree. Fear is always in my house. All men of courage have faith. It says it in the big book. What do you need courage for if you didn't have fear? You know, faith is required because I have fear. You know, and so if what happens for me is I can't pretend I don't have it. It's which one do I feed? And see, when I feed faith, I'm positive and I'm loving and I'm kind. And I see what's right in you, and I even see what's right in me. And when I feed fear, I'm negative, and I'm cynical, and I'm mean, and I see what's wrong in you, and I see what's wrong in me, and I see what's wrong in the whole world. And we talk about it in the one story in the big book. I'm like the guy that lolls in the Florida sunshine talking about how terrible the world is, right? So for me, it isn't whether I have fear. It's which one am I feeding, and that is my spiritual barometer to today. My grandmother taught me that, and she was my person, and I had a vision for what I would do for her when she was old and dying. And she was 83, and I didn't see that as old, but she died, and she didn't ask me if she could. But the big deal was when she died, she was afraid. She was afraid, and I thought, this little lady that's only been good to everybody, that's been my biggest spiritual example, God, how can you let her be afraid? I'm 11 years sober, and my spiritual example is terrified to meet God. I got mad at God, and I took a walk in the dark at 11 years sober. It's the last time I ever thought, and I seriously thought about blowing my brains apart, because what is the point of life without a spiritual connection? Once you've had the spiritual experience, without it is very lonely and very void. I did two things right. I did two things right, and that's why I believe I'm still sober. I went to AA, and I cried, and I told the truth. I didn't go to AA with my 11-year sober personality. You know, that one that we have to be that example, that person we're supposed to be. That's a lie some days. I didn't do that. I went and I told the truth. I was transparent, and I was authentic. I was honest. And I said, I can't feel God. And I'm lonely, and I'm angry. And the other thing that I did correct was I kept looking for God. See, that's all I have to do. God will meet me where I am. I didn't have to be on some mountaintop. All I got to do is want to meet God, and God will meet me. This went on from July of 1997 till February 1, 1998. Now, one of the things I bought myself in early recovery was a big old Harley Davidson. And I bought it because they told me to meditate. And I like Harleys. Well, I don't know about you, but I vibrated. Like, you know what I mean? And being still and and I smoked a lot. So being still and meditating, and that, you know, that firing squad, you know, like being still was a terrifying thing. I'd get on that Harley, and it would vibrate more than me, and it was louder than my head. And you know what would happen? I would feel God in the wind. I would feel God in the wind, because see, God will meet me where I am. I don't have to go, can you see me omen? I'm really not an omer, you know? And back then, there was no way that I could om. But you get me on that Harley, and I could feel God, because I wanted to. So, February 1, 1998, I got up on I-65 in Louisville, Kentucky, 65, 71, and 64, all meet. It's a big, crazy highway section in the middle of the country. It was 3 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon, and I got on my Harley, and I just, you know, I'm going to go see. And somebody come over in my lane. And I'm on the road maybe 10 minutes, doing somewhere between 65 and 70, and so is the rest of traffic, and this lady doesn't see me. And I can't ride out of it. There's a concrete thing over here. And so she hit me. I think it was a she. She took off. But I was thrown, according to police report, 17 foot in the air. And I come down, and there's a car driving down the center lane of the highway, and I land on the hood of that car. Now imagine that lady. That was a lady. you know? and I roll off of that car, and that car drives up me. And my lungs were collapsed, and my face got shredded by the undercarriage of that car, and my heart got shifted to the left, and I can't breathe, and I'm on the highway, and this eye's out of my head, and I don't know what's just happened. And traffic's, I'm in the center lane of a major highway, and traffic's coming, and I'm like, I'm going to get drove over. I realize I can't breathe, and I'm so scared. And think about it. Of course we're scared when we're dying. We're scared to change home groups, you know? It's unreasonable to think I'm not going to be scared when it's time to go to the big adventure. But I got scared in a way I never got scared, and I let go in a way I never let go. Because there's no choice. See, when you're dying, it's like you're not breathing. And it's like you can't make it different. You can't make it different. Talk about an acceptance that you can't make it different. And I had this beautiful near-death experience that happened to me. And I love to share it, because what happened for me was that when I let go, I got wrapped in white, billowy clouds of love. Nothing but love. Nothing, nothing, nothing but love. It was the most beautiful experience. And when I get frayed, I go back to that. That's my meditation place now, laying on the highway, feeling loved. And I absolutely never surprise anybody that I lived. Because I'm talking about it. But I didn't live without consequence. I had a lot of consequences. I had a spinal cord injury. I had a traumatic brain injury. Those were the two worst things. I had to learn to walk again and talk again. And I couldn't remember who you are 5 minutes after I met you. I couldn't remember your name. I still struggle with names. I have all these tools I use to get around in life. But at that time, I wouldn't remember you 10 minutes after I met you. Now it takes longer for me not to remember you, but but I remember how you feel. So if I ever hug somebody that I think I know, just understand. But I had seizures. I lost everything I owned. I had a small business. I lost my business. I lost everything financially. I wound up on Social Security disability and food stamps. I'm 12 years sober. What am I going to be? Where does my value come from? I lost my looks. See, the things I thought made me who I was I was bright, I was smart. I could earn more money than most of my peers. And I was cute. And my face, I look like this. I've had 27 surgeries on my face. My face has been reconstructed, and there's still a lot of scars. But what am I going to be? Where does my value come from? What matters of me? And you know what you guys did? You brought me newcomers. And you brought me newcomers that were feeling good and sorry for themselves. And they walk in my house. They take one look at me. and person Brahm say, tell Cindy what you told us in the car on the way over. That girl take one look at me and say, mm-mm. So we coach her, and she finally say, well, Cindy, my boyfriend left, and I just don't know how I'm going to go on. I'd have a seizure. She would instantly feel better. So here's the deal. I don't remember her name, okay? But what I know is that when people come to my house, they feel kind of sad. And when they leave my house, they feel good. I'm feeling a little like Gandhi. You know, I don't know why, but see, what I know is that somehow God is using me. And see, what I didn't do was I didn't say, God, no, for me to be spiritually useful, it needs to be like this. See, what I did was I let that be enough. I let having a seizure and helping somebody having a seizure and letting them see somebody in their most vulnerable state, I let that be enough for me to be a tool. And I kept letting them come. And you know what happened? My life had value. Because my value doesn't come from my looks or my intelligence or my money. My value comes from my ability to connect with and give to you. That is my value. How lucky am I? How blessed am I? You know, how blessed am I? And I'm going to tell you something. Now, there's a whole bunch more about to come. So I got on my little walker, and I learned to walk, and I did that. Nobody would hire me. I got a commission-only job, and I got back in the saddle, and that company got bought, and cool things happened, and I got a good job again. And this is like not quite 2 years since my wreck. I still got a bunch of surgeries to go through. I will always have consequences from that wreck. And then I get cancer. So I was 34 and 12 years sober when I had the wreck. Now I'm 14 years sober and 36 years old, and I got stage 3 breast cancer, which is a little bit advanced, especially at that age, and they treat it really aggressively. So I ended up spending the next year doing chemo and radiation, and it was hard. It's hard. I'm not going to lie. It's hard. But you know what? We had a head shaving party, and the girls took turns babysitting me. AA took care of me every time. They drove me to my doctor appointments. I couldn't drive when I had seizures. I didn't have family to come and take care of me. You guys did. You know, you guys have even bathed me. Like, wow. You know, and all the meals, and you just kept, and you brought them again when I had cancer, and they would show up. They had to give us a lecture at chemo because we were blowing bubbles, and they're like, somebody's going to slip and fall and hurt themselves. We're laughing. We're like, we got cancer. You know, I mean, like, so what? And so I get through that, and at the end, I worked, and the company I worked for went belly up, and one thing with my brain injury, I get a little distracted, and I apologize for that. But I started a business, a technology company, that I can't do anything it does, and I had $1,700 to my name, and I'm a recipient of the Traumatic Brain Injury Trust Fund, and I've got a lady that's coming to my house, and I don't know how to pay my bills, and so I'm sorting them all out on the floor trying to figure it out every night. I come home from a meeting, I spend hours studying my bills, what's due, so I don't miss something because I got no organizational skills, and I tell that lady, I said, guess what? She says, what? I said, I'm starting a business tomorrow. Let me tell you what she didn't do. She didn't say, what are you thinking? Why are you doing that? She said, if you need help there too, let me know. Let me tell you something. It's an international company today. I still can't do anything it does, but I got a lot of heart. And we're honest and we're transparent. And I have clients all over the world. And that's crazy cool. And part of it's because nobody said I couldn't. See, nobody said don't try. You guys taught me that anything's possible in Alcoholics Anonymous if I stay sober. 6-year period of time I had to wreck. I had a cancer. I ended up having to have a lower back fusion with instrumentation to cut part of my spinal canal. My spine was falling off. When I was a kid, I got kicked through doorways. My back got broke. When I had the accident, it exacerbated it. You know, I went through this great forgiveness process while I was in the hospital with that. that was cool. You know, like, I forgave my dad. And I'm a good daughter today, and that's another long story. But what a gift that came out of that. And I'm not a good daughter for him, and it's not whether he deserves it or doesn't deserve it. I'm a good daughter because I like myself. I'm a good daughter because I feel good about me. I don't stay if things aren't kind. I get to leave. I'm a grown-up, not a little kid anymore. But if things are okay and safe for me, I do a lot and I care a lot and I show up. And I'm very proud of myself for that. It is big healing. You know, somebody hurt him. Somebody hurt him. God love him. I forgive him. That's a really neat place to be. That's a different kind of freedom than I've ever known. Then again, in the 6-year period, I slipped through my attic. I had a Victorian house, and I was showing a contractor so they could turn my attic into a master bedroom. I slipped, I fell, I broke my neck. I fell 14 feet. I know, it's just crazy. If people in AA hadn't been there taking care of me the whole time, I wouldn't bother to tell you it because it just sounds so ridiculous. But my C5 split in half. I was paralyzed. I spent 3 months in the hospital. I've got an artificial neck. If you want to look on Facebook, I've got pictures. I'm like Legos. It's really kind of cool. The bottom line is my business kept going through all of this. Things kept going. Newcomers kept coming to the hospital. They used newcomers to drive me because I got an infection and when I got home, and they used newcomers to drive me at 7 in the morning. Who trusts a newcomer to pick somebody up at 7 in the morning? They showed up. I never missed an appointment. So what's the point of all this? The point of this, that's a lot of things to happen from 34 years old to 40. That's a lot. And be sober. And keep participating in AA. I went to AA on walkers. They brought meetings to my rooms. You know, sponsees fired me with good reason because wasn't mentally present. You know, and that's okay. But I stayed as much in the middle as somebody can be. And I'm going to tell you something. Everything comes full circle. I had a crummy childhood. I'm not going to pretend I didn't. I did. That's okay. If I didn't have that crummy childhood, I never could have handled this adulthood. See, that childhood prepared me. I didn't know that when I got sober. But because all these things had happened, I don't have a sense of entitlement. I never expected somebody to buy me a car. I never expected to go to college. I never expected to have things. So when I don't, and when things, I never expected to have good health. I never expected to have anything. But yet, these things happen. I roll with it. It's just life. I'm not mad. I don't think I'm supposed to get something different. That's my good news. I've been battling my whole life. It's normal for me. So lucky me, I had a childhood that prepared me to deal with this adulthood. And this is all AA is. Do I look at the glass half empty or half full? Am I willing to see what's good, or do I want to just focus on what's bad? You've given me permission to focus on what's good and be happy no matter what. Lucky me. Now, I'm going to tell you, I have had this really, I'm going to always have health issues. I've had a bazillion more surgeries. I've had a bunch of more almost dying things because you can't lay in hospitals for that long and have that many things happen and not have them have other things happen. I got diagnosed with strokes 3 times last summer. I don't think they were real strokes. I think my vascular system has a real issue because of the brain injury in my neck. But I was in an ICU stroke unit 3 times last summer, and it was scary. That's my life. That's my life. It's okay. It's okay, because as soon as I get going again, I'm back here on the road doing these things. I'm running my business. I'm sponsoring my girls. I'm all in. I'm all in. I'm not worried about what I didn't get to have. When I almost died, which I had, I got septic because of a colon surgery, and my brother got murdered. And my siblings call me mama sister because I run interference for them. You know what I mean? Like I that's my role. I love them. And I'm the oldest. And my brother was very good looking. He's like a tall Robert Redford. And he had some success. Nobody ever gave any of us anything. He used a hammer and he invested in houses. And he ended up having a lot of financial success. But he was a periodic crack user. And how you be a periodic crack user, I don't know. And we spent a whole week together on vacation in our 40s. After I broke my neck, he tried to take me surfing in Costa Rica. He had a house in Costa Rica because that's how we roll. And he spent the only week he spent in his adult life not using anything, not using nothing, and he didn't know he could. And so we taught each other how to fly in a different way. And it was so, I'm so grateful, because when he was probably in a crack deal, because it was in an alley, and he got shot 6 times in his truck, and he died. And it hurt me in a way that nothing ever has, and I can't tell you how or why. I can tell you that I don't judge him at all. I love him. I love him. He tried. The big book talks about those of us that come and really try. It talks about 50% of us make it at once. 25% of us, you know, make it a little later. And 25% of us, our lives get better if we participate here, but we never stay sober. I'm not judging anybody. I'm just grateful that I'm where I am today. It changed the way I looked at things. It changed the way I looked at people that relapsed. It changed the way I looked at the disease. It changed the way I look at everything. But anyway, my mother, I always wanted her to know how much she hurt us by not standing up for us. I always wanted her to hurt. I wanted her to know. My mama was sitting in the hospital with me, and my brother-in-law, he had multiple myeloma, and he's in D.C., and she's back and forth between the two hospitals. And my mother, the grief and the guilt and the shame that woman wore, all I wanted was for her to feel better. I didn't want her to hurt. That was a little kid that wanted to lash out. All I wanted was for her to feel better. I couldn't heal her, but I love her. And I don't want her to hurt. My brother wouldn't have wanted her to hurt. She couldn't forgive herself. I'm like, Mom, and I'm dying. And she's like, please don't die. I can't go through it. Please don't die. And so I'm going to try, you know. But a year later, my sister and I took my mom and my aunt to Kenya for 10 days. And it was my mom's, because in 70, she's doing this. So at 71, we took her to Kenya. And it was such a beautiful healing experience. My mother smiled and my mother laughed. And I love my mother. I love my mother. My mother hurts. She's wounded. I love her. And that's the answer. It's what you guys say, love and share. You know, love and share. And my life, I've been very clear that sobriety is not about money or things or any of that. But I'll tell you, it's really ironic. Right now, I've been without everything. I've been on food stamps sober, and I've been perfectly happy, maybe my most happiest. Today, I have a lot. I've traveled the world. I have offices in multiple states. I'm the CEO and founder of a really amazing company. I have another company that I've started, Tiny House, a Small House Business. My life is incredible. I've written for magazines on how to deal with chronic debilitating pain naturally. I get to help all kinds of people. I sit on a lot of nonprofit boards. I have a life that's like beyond my imagination. It sounds like I'm bragging. I'm not. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous and God lifted this little street urchin up and let everything be possible. And if all of that disappears tomorrow and I'm on food stamps and I'm broke and I'm back on disability, guess what? The most valuable thing in my life is still here, and that's you. See, the most valuable thing in my life is this. When we get to do this, this love and share that you talk about, when we get this connection, there's no, you can't buy it. Can't buy it. Can't buy it. I'm around a lot of really wealthy people because of my business. A lot of them are very unhappy. They don't have this. They don't have this. So what I seek is this. What I hold precious is this. What I want more than anything, because I have a big life that's really busy. It's too busy for me to be here this weekend. It's really too busy. And I'm not kidding. It's like way too busy. But it's too busy for me not to be here. You see, because the reason it's busy and the reason I have anything is because of you. You've given me a life worth living, and I thank you very much.